Good evening, everyone. My name is Hank Johnson. I'm an alcoholic. And I want to, before I forget, I generally do, I want to thank whoever's responsible for asking me to come down here and talk. I used to drink a lot. I thought I'd better throw that in, too, so you didn't think you were dealing with an imposter here. You know, I drank a lot. My son says that I'm just a basic fifth of vodka a day drinker. But what does he know? He just saw me at night, you know. He didn't see all the social drinking I was doing during the day when I should have been working. And what happened to me is I walked into a bar in Los Angeles when I was 18 years old. And you're supposed to be 21. And I ordered a drink over the bar, and the guy served me, and immediately I became a man. That's what I wanted to be, a man, and a man can order a drink over a bar and not be asked how old he is. And I graduated right then and there, and I didn't have to learn anything else for the rest of my life. What else is there? If you can buy a drink, you know, who needs anything else? And I felt comfortable in that bar. You know, sometimes I hear people say when they came into AA, their very first meeting they walked into, they just felt like they really comfortable, and it felt like they came home. You know, geez, I didn't feel that way at all about AA. But I sure felt that way in that bar. I knew I was home. I knew I belonged there. I was comfortable there. I enjoyed everything about that place, and I could play the jukebox over in the corner just as good as the rest of the guys. In fact, I thought my selection of songs were a little better than most. And I could sit at the bar and look at myself in the mirror and get better looking after each drink. And I just went back every opportunity I had from then on. From then on, alcohol was the focal point of my life. From then on, everything I did in social nature, alcohol was involved. And I was under the influence of alcohol for the next 30 years. I don't mean I was drunk every minute of that time, but I was either drinking or thinking about drinking or recovering from drinking. And it was the focal point of my life. Everything I've ever learned in a social nature, I did while drinking. You know, about the only thing that I ever learned to do without booze was work. But everything else, I drank along with it. And I wouldn't do it if drinking didn't go along with it. And I got married and met a gal in a bar, and we got married. Where else do you meet girls? And we got married. We bought a little house and moved to the West Covina, California. It's really in the eastern part of Los Angeles area, and we set up housekeeping there. And you know, those payments had come due on that house, and I just couldn't make the payments. You know, I used my money to drink with. And those payments would come due first of each month. And you know, I just couldn't come up with the money. So I'd just say, well, I think what I'll do is I'll double up next time. I won't make the payment this month, but next month I'll make two payments. And it sounded reasonable to me, you know. And next month, two payments were due, plus a late charge. And what am I going to do? How can I make the payment? And so I'd stiff all my other creditors, and somehow I'd make the payment. And we almost lost that house several times. And we finally sold it and moved in with my father for free. And somebody would have asked me, Hank, what is your problem? I would have said, money. Money's my problem. You know, I just don't make enough. I don't know how I got involved in this work I do. It just doesn't pay enough. And and if she'd only go to work and help out a little bit. But it turned out she was pregnant. And She already had a baby by a previous marriage, and now here comes number two, and I didn't start saving for that baby until about a week before it was due. I couldn't come up with, I had to go to the beneficial finance company and borrow the money to pay the hospital and medical expenses when my son was born. And when he turned 25 years old and I finally got sober in AA, I finally got beneficial paid off. I don't know about you, but I always had a crisis in my life. Every time I'd almost get those guys paid off, something would happen, and I'd have to go back and reconsolidate all my bills and into, and by the time I came into AA, I had reconsolidated all my bills into one big impossible payment. But money is my problem. And my drunkologue is really, it's a very boring story. I'm sure you're going to hear more exciting things later on in this convention, in this roundup, because I kind of sat around and drank. I'm an observer of life. I just kind of just sit around and watch you. And I know I could do a hell of a lot better than you guys do. If I really wanted to. I don't want to. What happened is that I drank my wife away, my children away, my home away. I drank everything away except my job. That's the only thing I had left. Well, there she comes. And I just drank everything away. And my wife divorced me for the third time. And I ended up in a little shack in Hermosa Beach, California. And it was a garage, is what it was, that they had made some living quarters. And there was a room like 12 by 15 or something like that. It's just a little place. I could drink the way I wanted to drink. And all I had left was my job. And I worked for this big company. It was kind of a prestigious company. They had my name on one of their business cards. And that's who I was. And if they fired me, that's it. I'd be down the tubes. And a typical day was that I would wake up, it'd be 10 o'clock in the morning, and I'm already an hour late to work. Oh, man, I'd throw my clothes on and get in that car, weave in and out, and I had to get there. You see, I should have worked yesterday. I left all those papers all over my desk. I had papers in my desk drawer. Some of them are months old. They were too old to turn in. If I turned them in, I'd be fired for holding them so long. If I didn't turn them in, I knew I was going to be fired. And today was the day it was going to happen. I had that feeling of impending doom. I never heard that expression until I came to AA, but that's the feeling I had, a feeling of impending doom. And I'd get to work, and I'd check everything out. Everything is the same as yesterday, and saved again, there was no note to see the boss or anything, and I'd go get a cup of coffee in the coffee room and come back to my desk and shuffle papers and make excuses, and at a respectable time, about 11:30 or so, I'd go out to lunch. And I'd go to the lunch at the bar that was conveniently located right next door to where I worked. And they sold martinis over there. And I like martinis. And they sold double martinis during the lunch hour for $1. The regular martinis were 75 cents. When I think now, I went to a nice restaurant recently and they wanted $3.75 for a martini. Gee, even if I wouldn't have quit, I couldn't have drank very much longer. I can't afford those kind of prices. But regular ones were 75 cents, and the double was a dollar. And I figured, whoever heard of having one martini? You're going to have two anyhow, so you might as well order the dollar one, and you'll save 50 cents. God knows you need the money bad. And so I'd have this double, and I'd get to sipping on it, and I'd kind of check my drink against the guy sitting next to me, and he'd have a 75-center, and I'd say to myself, who do they think they're kidding? This isn't really a double. It's a little larger than the 75-center, that's all. If it were really a double, they'd be charging more money for it. Who do they think they're dealing with around here anyhow? So I better have another one. And then I'd have another one. And then I'd have another one. And then I'd call the office and tell them, forgot to tell you, I'm going on a lot of calls this afternoon. Take messages. I'll be back tomorrow morning at 9 o'clock. And I'd head towards the beach. And I'd stop and buy the cheapest bottle of vodka I could find, whatever was on sale that day. You know, in the Los Angeles area, there's a liquor store on every corner. And I'd buy the cheapest bottle I could find. And I'd get home about 2 or 2:30 in the afternoon. And I'm kind of a neat drunk. I'd get home and I'd change my clothes, you know. I'd hang up my clothes real carefully so the creases fall properly, you know, and put my shoes away and everything. I'd put my pajamas on. And it'd be like 2 o'clock in the afternoon. And I'd sit on the edge of the bed and I'd untap that cheap vodka. And I'd just take a big jolt of that stuff, you know, several swallows. And I'd say to myself, well, done it again today. This cannot continue. You know, you're not the only guy that's ever been divorced. You're not the only guy that's ever been in debt. Why don't you do something about it? You just sit around and talk about stuff. You never take any action on anything. And then I'd put one of those old records on the turntable. Something like Billy Eckstein singing, Who Can I Turn To? And then I'd go into my fantasy about starting tomorrow. Starting tomorrow, it's all going to be different. Starting tomorrow, a whole new life is going to open up for me. Starting tomorrow, I'm going to get up at 6 o'clock. I'm going to get down to that damn office by 7. I'm going to knock out paperwork for a couple hours. When that phone starts ringing tomorrow, I'm going to be ready to do business. And starting tomorrow, every waking moment, I'm going to be earning money starting tomorrow. You know, I'm in sales. I can work any hours I want to work. And I'm going to work, starting tomorrow, I'm going to work 365 days in a row. I'm going to put a big red X on the calendar, and I'm going to work for 365 days in a row. And starting tomorrow, I'm not even going to drink for a whole year starting tomorrow. Man, what a terrific idea. That's the solution to my financial problems anyhow. I can't do anything about that marriage, but at least, you know, I could just, I don't know about you, but I tend to project. And I could just see how things were going to be 365 days from now. I'll be out of debt. You know, I'll have money in the bank. I'll have a new car and clothes, and it'll just be wonderful. And I could just see myself. And so I just decided to celebrate a job well done. You know, just a little early. And then I think about what I was going to do with all the money. And I had all kinds of plans for it, and I'd look up at the clock, and it was 10:45. Yeah. It can't be 10:45. I just sat down here on the edge of the bed, you know. It just seemed like an hour, half hour went by. It can't be that late. So I'd call the operator, 10:45. My God. Where's this time gone? I just can't believe it. Then I realized I was out of booze, almost. And I'd throw my clothes on over my pajamas, and I'd run 2 blocks to the liquor store. I had to get there before it closed at 11. That's when I first started jogging, about that time. And I'd get there just as they were closing up in a bottle of Smirnoff's. I always bought the better brands right around where I lived. I wouldn't want anybody to think I was cheap right there in the neighborhood. And I could stroll back to my shack with peace and contentment and security for the rest of the night. I'd go back there and I'd rehearse the speech I was going to have to give because I was going to be salesman of the year. And somewhere in there I'd pass out. And I'd wake up the next morning and it would still, you know, wake up, it'd be 10 o'clock. I'm already an hour late to work. Oh, man. I'd throw my clothes on, get in that car, weave in and out. I had to get there. I should have worked yesterday. I left all those papers. And I'd go back and check my desk out. Everything's the same as yesterday. Phew, saved again. Go to the coffee room, get some coffee, come back to my desk and shuffle papers and make excuses. And at a respectable time, I'd go to lunch at the bar that was conveniently located right next door to where I worked. And I'd go over there and make my big decision of the day, whether to have the dollar one or the 75-center. Then I'd have another one, then I'd have another one, then I'd have another one. Then I'd call and tell them I forgot to tell you. Go on a lot of calls, take messages, be back tomorrow morning at 9 o'clock. And I'd head toward the beach and get home about 2 after buying the cheapest bottle of vodka I could find, change into my pajamas and sit on the edge of the bed and untap that cheap vodka and take a big, big jolt out of it. And I'd say to myself, you know, well, done it again today. You know, this cannot continue. You're not the only guy that's ever been divorced. You're not the only guy that's ever been in debt. Why don't you do something about it? You just sit around and talk about stuff. You never take any action on anything. You know? Then I'd put one of those old records on the turntable. Something like Billy Eckstein singing, "Who Can I Turn To?" Then I'd go into my fantasy. But starting tomorrow, it's all going to be different. Starting tomorrow, I'm going to get up at 6 o'clock. I'll get down to that office by 7. It knock out paperwork. And when that phone starts ringing at 9, I'm going to be ready to do business. And starting tomorrow, I'm going to work a 365 days in a row. I'm going to put a big red X on the calendar. And I'm going to work every waking moment. I'm going to be earning money. And you know, I didn't do that once or twice. I did that hundreds of times. And the boss would want to know towards the end of the month, you know, he'd say, "You in sales here?" And I'd say, "Yeah, I'm in sales." He said, "Well, how about making a sale?" And I'd say, "Don't worry about a thing. I'm a fast finisher." And I was. And that, I really would work around the clock then because I was afraid of losing my job. You know, it really wasn't the money. God knows I needed it bad, but I was afraid of losing that job because that was my last little bit of respectability that I had. And I really would work around the clock. And that company I worked for, if you made your quota or exceeded it, they gave you a plaque at the end of the year. And, you know, get a big plaque with your name on it. Outstanding salesmanship and product knowledge and being the type of representative we want to represent this company and all that good stuff all over that plaque. For 8 drunken years in a row, I won a plaque every year. And then I got sober. Then I didn't win a plaque for 8 years. You know, what happened to me is I lost my fear. You know, I was afraid before. And when I got sober, it wasn't that much of a big deal to me. I don't know, after I got in AA for a while, I realized that if I lost my job, I'd get another one. And it wouldn't be the end of the world. And so I just kind of stopped working. In fact, what happened to me is what happened to a lot of people in AA. I see it all the time. And I had about 2 years of sobriety. And I walked in the office one time, and the boss said, "You're fired." And I said, "Fired? You know, you got to be kidding. I've got an outstanding sales record with this company." He said, "Not lately, you don't." And I said, "Well, I'm going to go over your head. I'm not going to take this from you, you know." And I went to the regional manager and talked my way back in to the company. I couldn't work in that office, but he told me, he says, you claim to be a salesman. He says, why don't you sell yourself to another office? He said, we got 80 of them. And that's what I did. But you see, what happened to me is I got in AA and I found God. And I got so spiritual that I was walking about 2 or 3 feet off the ground. And I didn't have to work. They should give me a raise just for showing up in the morning. You know, because I'm spiritual. And, you know, I didn't realize this, that everybody comes to work on time, you know. But I thought I was really making a big sacrifice. You know, if they knew what I had been through, they wouldn't, you know, they would realize what big deal it is for me showing up here, you know, on time. And so I just got so spiritual that I just kind of sailed off into the blue. And I used to spend about 90% of my day back then calling other members of Alcoholics Anonymous on company time. And I should have been fired, you know. I was stealing from the company, in a sense. And I was spending about 90% of my time on the phone with other members of Alcoholics Anonymous. I might not have stayed sober. I don't know. But anyway, the guy wanted to fire me, and I was able to transfer to another office. But my sponsor finally got a hold of me on this thing, and he says, you know, Hank, he says, I've been watching you lately. He says, and you know, some of us here in AA get so spiritual that we just become almost heavenly. We just become of no earthly good to anybody. And he pointed out that in the book, Alcoholics Anonymous, it states in there that it's okay to have your head in the clouds, but we should keep our feet firmly planted on the ground, because that's where our fellow travelers are, and that's where the work is to be done. And that's what I've been trying to do ever since. And before all that happened, my son had to come and live with me, because he went off. He was 16 years old. He went off and got drunk and at a Christmas party or whatever it was. So my ex-wife called and said, come and get your drunken son. He's just like you are. So he had to come and live with me. And he didn't want to, and I didn't want him to. But she said, so we had to do it, right? I had no self-worth back then. If he, you know, whatever anybody told me, I would do it, you know. And what I should have said is, hey, wait a minute. You divorced me, remember? You've got custody of the kid, you know. You won the kid. So if you're having a little trouble with him, deal with it. You know, don't bother me now. You know, that's what I should have said. But I didn't. And he came to live with me. And, you know, it's a funny thing. I kind of cut down on my drinking. And we had a little chemistry going there. And we did well together. And he was doing better in school and everything else. And my wife came down to visit one Sunday, checking her son out, you know. And one thing led to another. And we went back together again. You know? She said, you know, I won't even fight you on your drinking anymore. In fact, I'll join you. And I should have been suspicious, but I wasn't, you know. But during all those years I was married to her, she never drank. She's just one of these people that couldn't drink. You know, she'd drink one drink or something. And she just couldn't handle the stuff. And little did I know that during that 2 or 3 year period we were apart, she had started drinking. And she had become an alcoholic. And she was a full-blown alcoholic when she moved back in with me. And here we were, the three of us, living in this little place. And we converted the garage part of the garage house into a bedroom, threw a carpet down and on the floor, and it was exposed beams, you know, exposed garage. And we were living there. And that's when the trouble really started. that we could never drink together. We never could drink successfully together with just one big argument after another. And I used to kid the guys down at work, I think I'll go home and start up the argument again. And, you know, we just didn't get along. And one time I told her, I said, you know, I allowed you to kick me out of all those houses before, but I moved here first, therefore you go this time, you know. And I'm going to go stay at my brother's house tonight. And when I come back tomorrow morning, I expect you to be out of here. That's more time than you ever gave me. And so she decided, while I was gone, she decided to commit suicide, which was no big deal with her. She was always doing that. In fact, she was suicidal right into AA. She had about 8 or 10 months of sobriety in AA. And she was at work one day, and she realized how terrible everything was, and she just decided she'd going to kill herself when she got home that night. And she got home, then she remembered she was the cookie lady at the meeting that night, so she had to postpone it. You know? And then her sponsor finally got to her and said, you know, you better knock this stuff off. You know, one of these days you're going to hurt yourself real bad. But that night, in a blackout, she was going to do it. And but before she did, she went into the closet where my clothes were hanging and just took a knife and just slashed every stitch of clothes I owned, just ripped everything to pieces, cut the pant legs off my pants and my shirts and cut my ties in half and even stabbed my damn shoes. You know? Then she went out in the living room and she pulled the drapes off the windows, you know, and she broke all the records, and she broke the lamps, and smashed the pictures, and took all the rags and the drapes and tried to make the place airtight, and then she turned the gas on, kitchen oven, and went to bed. And next morning, she woke up, yeah, and she came out of this blackout, and she turned the gas off. And that old place we lived was just a half a block from the ocean, and the wind used to whistle through those boards of that old house, that old garage, and you could have turned the gas on 10 ovens and never smelled it in there. You know? And she survived. But she looked around, and she knew she had been the only person that stayed there that night. And she knew she had done it, but she didn't remember doing it. It really scared her a lot. And so she went back to this therapist that had told me that I ought to go to AA. And his wife was in AA. And so she had been with me and heard all what this doctor had said. So she went back and talked to the doctor and asked him if he thought she was an alcoholic. And he said he didn't know, but why didn't she go to some meetings with his wife? She'd be happy to take her. And that's why I'm standing here tonight. Because, you see, I had gone to a meeting a couple of years prior to that. It was one of these meetings that in Los Angeles, they give chips at the beginning of the meeting there, a little different system than they do here. And if they give them at all, a lot of meetings they don't give chips. But this meeting that I went to, they give chips at the beginning of the meeting. And the guys asked that night, is there anyone here that just finished their first 30 days of sobriety? If so, come up and get a chip and say a few words. So here comes this guy, you know. Get a 30-day chip. My name's Joe Blow, and I'm an alcoholic, and I'm really proud to get this chip. And I know this is a spiritual program that I found God when I walked through the doors of AA. And it's the lights in the eyes of the people that just turn me on and keep me coming to these meetings. And I just love everybody. You know? And just before I came to the meeting tonight, I got a call from my employer, and he's made me general manager down at the plant. It's just a wonderful, glorious way of life, and for all you newcomers, keep coming back. We love you. And I thought, my God, you know, this made my skin crawl, you know. And he said, and then anyone else? And here comes this lady up. You know. My name is Mary Smith, and I'm an alcoholic, and I'm really proud to get this chip. And I know this is a spiritual program, that I found God when I walked through the doors of AA. It's the lights in the eyes of the people that just turn me on and keep me coming back to these meetings. And I just love everybody. Hate is no longer a word in my vocabulary. You know. Just before I came to the program, when my children, when our eyes met, they had a look of fear in their eyes. And now, when our eyes meet, there's a look of respect. And I've noticed lately that my husband is looking at me with renewed interest. And it's just a wonderful, glorious way of life here. And my children were failing in school, and now we're getting letters from all the major universities throughout the United States offering free scholarships. Just a wonderful, glorious way of life here. And I wake up in the morning and I reach over and I grab the hand of God, and we walk through the day hand in hand. And if there's any newcomers here, keep coming back. We love you. And I thought, oh man, we're, you know, I wasn't able to stay for the whole meeting that night. I needed a drink. And I went and got one. Or 20. I don't know. I needed the drink. And so she went down and talked to the doctor, and the doctor's wife's going to take her to meetings. You know. And I told her, I said, geez, when you go there, be careful. You know, but, you know, it's just watch your step when you. And that's the reason I'm standing up here tonight, because she went to AA. I don't know if I'd ever gone back. Maybe I would. I don't know. I can't. You know, you can't say. But I just wasn't interested in AA at all. I thought it was kind of some kind of a religious cult of some kind, you know. And I didn't know what they were doing exactly. And if they want to go to it, okay. But it wasn't anything that I was interested in. And but to be a good guy, I'd go to a meeting with her every once in a while. And one day, my wife came to me and said, you know, the doctor's wife, my sponsor by now, she was her sponsor, you know, and said, my sponsor thinks it would be a good idea if you went today to a meeting. And it's an anniversary meeting in Hawthorne, a little city close to where we were living. And clubhouse there, and it's their 10th anniversary or whatever it was. And there's a guy going to be speaking there this afternoon that she thinks you would like. And I said, well, you know, it's football on TV this afternoon, and you know, it's an inconvenient time to go. So I said, well, I'll go. And I went. And the guy's name was Clancy, and a lot of people have heard him speak all over the United States, and he had about 11 years at that time, and he said, you know, at first thing he said, he introduced himself, and he said that, you know, I'd really much rather be at home watching a football game this afternoon, but he says, you know, I just never turned down an AA request, and you just can't turn down an AA request when they ask you, so here I am. And I, well, as soon as he said that, I thought, you know, I know what you mean, you know. I'd much rather be home watching TV, watching football, too. And so he went on. He gave a really good talk. I laughed maybe for the first time a long time at him and his shenanigans that he went through. My God. He was sent to the Texas State Insane Asylum, sober. He committed suicide sober. He couldn't stand sobriety. And he wasn't going to any meetings, And he got thrown in Texas State Insane Asylum, and he tried to escape. And he jumped over the wall, and he was running through the Texas plains in his terry cloth robe, and they were looking at him with spyglasses. Really a funny story he was telling, And I laughed. And he went on and on, and just really good. And then towards the end of his talk, he nailed me. Towards the end of his talk, he said, all the things that I've done, he says, drunk and sober, he says, I've been able to get forgiveness for. He says, or I've made amends. And he says, and he says, I don't have to worry about those things that I've done. And he said, that's over with. But he says, I'm still having trouble with the things I should have done. The sins of omission. And he got talking about that, and he nailed me. I identified. Up until that time, I hadn't identified with any speakers or anyone else in AA, for that matter. But I thought, geez, that's me. I should have been a better son. I should have been a better husband. I should have been a better father. I should have been a better employee. I should have. And he nailed me, and I could hardly wait to get out of there, because I can't stand the truth about myself. I can't stand the truth. Don't tell me the truth about me. I can just barely stand it about you. But I don't want to face the truth about myself. I can't handle it. And I could hardly wait for that meeting to be over so I could go get a drink. And that's the first thing I did, and I got out of there. And then I don't know how she found out, but she found out where he was talking. And we used to go on Friday night to hear Clancy speak, We'd go to dinner first, and I'd have a few martinis, and she wasn't drinking. And I'd have a few martinis, and we'd go hear Clancy, and nice dinner, and then we'd on our way to Cucamonga or someplace to hear him talk. And we'd go there and listen to him, and then we'd argue on the way home what he really meant. And how come he didn't throw that part in that he said last week? And I must have heard him about 10 times. It was a great evening's entertainment, better than TV. That's what we did. It never occurred to me not to drink in between meetings. I never said anything to him. I just went to hear him. And so I heard another speaker one time. He was talking about his sponsor. I was getting pressure from these groups I was going to. I was going to meetings, but haphazardly. I wasn't, By then I did quit drinking, and I was I was sober, but I was dry, And I was getting pressure put on me to get a sponsor. And so this guy, I heard this guy talk, and he was talking about his sponsor. Sponsored this, and his sponsor that, and he'd go over to his sponsor's house and go in the backyard with him and play volleyball in the backyard, and just wonderful, and he just talked so highly of him. So after the meeting, I asked this guy, I said, who is your sponsor anyhow? I said, he says, a guy by the name of Clancy. I said, oh, yes. I said, I know him. I said, I've heard him speak several times. And so he invited me to go up to Clancy's house on the following Saturday. And a bunch of alcoholics get together over there at his place. And he lives across the street from a park and play baseball and stuff and just keep busy on Saturdays instead of drinking. And so I went up there. And I didn't ask him to be my sponsor. This guy Bill said, this guy, he said, this is Hank, and Hank wants you to be his sponsor. And I, wait a minute, I'm not so, And so he had to go someplace to talk, and he said, come down to my office on Monday, if you can. And he says, and we'll talk about it. And so I did, and went down there, and I had to go clear across town, and I was almost out of gas, and I said, well, I'll get gas, before I get on the freeway. Well, past the first station, and it was too high. I can get a little cheaper down the road, and it was higher even than the first one. And somehow I ended up on the freeway, and with no gas. And I just sweated it, and I just drove down to his office on fumes. And I made it. I made it to his office. And my two front tires were ready to blow out. And I had the money in my pocket. I just couldn't do anything back then, And I was shopping around for the best deal. And I never could get anything done unless it was an emergency. Then I'd have to do it. And that's the only time I did anything. And when I got there, and I said, I don't know, Clancy, what's wrong with me? Nothing. I've seen the be okay, except that I can't get anything done. And I said, I drove down here on fumes, and my two front tires are ready to blow out, and I've got the money, I can buy it. I'm just, he said, direction. He says, I'm going to write this down so you can understand it. He says, when you leave this office, number one, stop at the first gas station and fill up your tank, regardless of what brand they're selling. And while you're there, ask them, number two, ask them if they sell tires. If they sell tires, buy two front tires. He said, then have a sandwich, number three, have a sandwich, number four, call me. And I did that, and I thought, gee, that's pretty good, this sponsorship is really all right, I did it all perfectly, and I called him up and told him, He said, now why don't you go back to the office and catch up on some of that back paperwork you're talking about, and that started it, And he agreed to be my sponsor, providing I would go to a couple of the same meetings that he went to. He said, he wanted me to call him every day, but he wanted to see me. He said, I just don't want to sponsor you over the phone. I want to see you, see what you're up to, And so he insisted that I go to a couple of meetings that he attended. And one of them was the Pacific Group in Los Angeles. And at that time, it was... it's a big meeting compared to the meetings here in the South, but it had about 200 people, and now there's between 1,000 and 1,200 people attend that meeting every Wednesday night in Los Angeles. It's the largest meeting in the world that meets on a regular basis, but it was about 200 people about that time, and the format of that meeting is. Two 10-minute speakers, then a coffee break, and then a main speaker, hour-and-a-half meeting. And they pick speakers on the way in. You never know when you're going to get tagged. The main speaker, he knows that he's going to talk, but they just pick the 10-minute speakers on the way in. And so after, there was only the second or third time I'd gone to that meeting, and the secretary there, he says, Hank, you're the second 10-minute speaker tonight. I said, what? I said, just a minute. Wait a minute. I said, I'm new. He said, that's okay. Doesn't matter. Just get up and tell us about yourself. 10 minutes. I said, no, it's not okay. to anybody. He says, yeah, you can. And I said, you don't seem to understand. He said, what are you saying? You pass? And I said, that's it. I pass. I said, catch me in about 6 months. I'll be happy to do it. And he says, we don't pass at this meeting. He says, at this meeting, when you're asked to do something, we consider it an AA request. And you never, ever turn down an AA request. I don't know what to tell you, you know. And he says, oh, why don't you just go in and sit down and enjoy the meeting? And he says, maybe next week you can find another meeting to go to. You know, if you don't want to participate here, you find yourself another meeting next week. He says, somewhere where you can be a spectator. You know, there's all kinds of meetings that you can go to and be a spectator, and it's okay to say no. And you can just find a meeting like that to go to. You know. And I said, oh, okay, I'll talk. Geez, you know. And so I did. And the first 10, you know, you see, I didn't have time to prepare my talk. Had I known that I was going to be a 10-minute speaker, I could have read the book. You know, I could have got some of those great lines out of the book, maybe written them down and had them here, you know, with me right up at the podium and read them off to you and laid them on you, you know. But I didn't have time. You know, I didn't have time to prepare my talk. And the first 10-minute speaker spoke. I don't know who he was or she. It could have been a two-headed man for all I know. And I was into myself, and I was worried, and, you know, and they called my name. And I got up there, and I said, my name's Hank Johnson, and I'm an alcoholic. And I said, I hate AA. And I said, you know, I said, everybody else seems to be doing real well. But I said, since I haven't had a drink for almost six months now, and I said, and my life is getting worse. I said, it wasn't all that good before I came in to AA, but it's worse now, you know. And you see, and so I just talked like that. And then I said, I'm having trouble with my wife, and the kids are driving me crazy, and the financial situation, and everything, work, everything, just going down the tubes. And I said, I just don't know how much longer I'm going to be able to last, you know, to hang in here, you know. And so then I stopped, and my 10 minutes were up, and I stopped, and they all clapped, hey, you know, wonderful, you know. And then we had a coffee break, and the miracle of AA happened right then and there. Because you see, I stood up and I told the truth about myself, and I didn't flower it up or anything, you know. I told the truth, and I was still accepted. You know, I was unconditional acceptance by about 200 people. Unconditional love from 200 people. It was just overwhelming. And that's when the miracle of AA happened for me. And I could hardly wait for the next assignment, you know. God, I was really into it now. I belong here now, you know. And I had jobs. I was swabbing the decks, and I was, you know, setting up meetings and making coffee and being a treasurer of meetings. And I had a job every night of the week. And I was really into it. And I think that's one of the reasons I'm sober here today, because I got active in AA. And I feel sorry for spectators. There's a lot of spectators in AA, and they're the ones that aren't having any fun. You know, the people that are having fun are the people that are busy and active, and I feel sorry for them. But they know better. They know it's all, you know. I just heard a tape by a friend of mine. He was talking, he had to clean up the meeting for a year and a half. He was cleaning up his meeting, you know, and he knew they were using him, you know. And he had to sweep the floor after every meeting, and he just knew they were using him. And what's this got to do with finding God and being spiritual, you know. And he woke up one day, he realized as he was sweeping up, he realized he knew the name of everybody at the meeting. And it was a spiritual thing for him. So, one thing led to another. Everything wasn't all that great after that, even though I did like AA then, and I got so that I really cared about it. I could hardly wait till the next day so I could go to a meeting. And I felt safe in the meetings. And, it's kind of like being in enemy territory all day and then be able to go to a meeting at night and relax and feel safe. And that's the way I felt. And things went along. And I remember, but it wasn't perfect by any stretch of the imagination. And I called my sponsor one Monday morning. It was about 10 o'clock in the morning. And I said, you know, you want me to go to all these meetings, but I said, there's something more wrong with me than just alcoholism. You know, I've got some deep, dark psychological problems. I can't tell you what they are. But I said, you know, I went to therapy off and on for 15 years. And I said, I know the answer is there somewhere. But when I went to therapy and all that, I was still drinking then. But now I'm sober. And I'll be able to get a good therapist and go to two or three times a week and dig into my past and really find out what's wrong. You know? And so I won't be able to go to all the meetings that you want me to go to. He says, where are you? And I said, I'm at home. He says, well, it's 10 o'clock in the morning. He said, I've already been at work for over an hour. He said, there's nothing psychologically wrong with you today. He said, you're just not where you're supposed to be right now, that's all. And he says, why don't you get dressed and go to work? And he said, you'll be embarrassed when you get there, maybe for a few minutes being late, but that'll be over in a few minutes. And he said, then call me. And so I did that. I went and I was embarrassed and I sat down. Finally, it was okay. And I called him and I said, yeah, I do feel better now that I'm where I'm supposed to be. Yeah. And it turns out that I don't have any deep, dark psychological problems. I'm just lazy, that's all. I don't want to do these things that you want me to do here. I want you to do them for me somehow. And pass it on to me some way. And I want to fantasize about how the world really should be, you know. And it turns out I don't have any deep, dark psychological problems. You know? And I just need to get into action. And I don't mean sweeping floors. I mean active in working the steps of AA, where the real action is. And so I did that. I worked these steps. And I took my inventory and my fifth step and sixth and seventh, and I was on my eighth step, and I went over to Clancy's backyard one Saturday, and there was a guy there, Byron, and he says, you know, Hank, he says, a lot of us spent money just like we drank, completely out of control. And he says, we're going to have a little meeting over at my house on Monday night if you want to come over. He says, we're going to take a financial inventory of ourselves. And he said, if you want to come over. He says, bring all your bills with you. Yeah. And he says, and bring your pay stubs. I didn't want to bring my pay stubs. I didn't want anybody to know how much I really made, you know. I was wearing tailor-made suits back in those days. Yeah. You know, no shorts, but I had tailor-made suits. I looked good, you know. And And so, but I did. I went over there. And I had, he said, bring all your bills. I had two drawers full of bills. Now, by then, I was just afraid. Every time the mailman came, I was just afraid, you know. Every time the phone rang, I jumped clear across the room, and it would be a bill collector. And I was really in bad trouble financially. And so I brought all those bills over to his house. And, you know, if we'd have stacked them up, it would have been about a yard high, you know. I had so many bills. And before I left his house that night, I had reduced my indebtedness by two-thirds. You see, we just threw away all the duplicates and the triplicates. And we just kept one copy of each bill. And that stack went down two-thirds. It was still bad, but it wasn't as bad as I thought it was. And, you know, I have found that to be true in AA. I carry stuff around in my head, and I tend to build it up and way out of proportion. And I've been taught in AA, hey, make a list. Make a list of what you need to do. And it's a lot of times it's bad, but it's not nearly as bad as carrying around in my head. And so I started paying off my bills. It was an impossible situation. We wrote letters to my creditors. We wrote and told them, I fully acknowledge that I owe you this money, but I'm unable to pay as previously agreed upon. Please accept check for $10. I'll be sending you $10 a month until my financial picture changes. Thank you very much. And by return mail, I'd get a letter. Unacceptable. Send full balance or legal action will be taken. You know, sometimes a telegram, but they never did. And they always cashed the $10 check. And you know, it took me 3 years to get current. I don't mean paid off. I mean for my bills to be current. And that was a big red letter day for me in AA. That I could walk down the street, and if I met somebody, chances are I didn't owe him any money. Or if I did owe him some money, I was current. And that was a good feeling. That was a real good feeling. And so we had about 11 years of sobriety, and we moved up to the desert north of Los Angeles, and we were going to retire up there. And my wife came and told me that she had gone, went to the doctor, and she came and told me that she had cancer. She had just gone, went to the doctor, and the doctor told her she'd got lung cancer and got 90 days to live. And I thought, my God, not now, you know, what now? I didn't accept that news very well. It was inconvenient for me for her to have cancer. You know? And I felt, you know, kind of ashamed for that thought. But what's the use of planning, you know? And so I went to my meeting that night, because you always go to your meeting if it's meeting night. You know, it's no excuse not to go to your meeting. If it's cold or warm or whatever, you go to your meeting if it's meeting night. And regardless of how you feel good, you go to your meeting. You feel bad, you go to your meeting. If it's meeting night, you go to your meeting. And in fact, there's a guy from Moorhead, Minnesota, that spoke down in Myrtle Beach here at the Sand Lapper. And he said, the only time you don't go to your meeting is if there's a death in the family, yours. And that's the only time you're excused from your regular meeting. And so I went to my regular meeting that night. And I thought, well, I was driving over there. You know, you haven't really worked these steps. You say you have, but you really haven't, you know. You're not, you know, you wouldn't have these bad thoughts if you'd really worked the steps properly. And I went to the meeting, And during the meeting, you know, it was just a regular, okay meeting. And at the end of it, in Southern California, a lot of times they read the last page of the book, Alcoholics Anonymous, on page 164. They read, "Ask in your morning meditation what you can do for the man who is still sick. The answers will come if your own house is in order." And that hit me that night. I have heard that read hundreds of times, but it really hit me that night. Because, and I said, yeah, that's it. My house is in order. You know, our house is in order. I had long since paid off all those bills, you know. And I was current in all my affairs. And everything that needed to be said between her and me had long been said. And I knew that when I walked out of that meeting, I knew that I was going to be able to be of some help to her. And I did. And I was. And she lasted 5 years. And some of it good and some of it bad. And she died in January of 1986, right after her 16th AA birthday. And when she died, you know, I thought, geez, you know, that's when sometimes you wonder, you know, what's God's will? How come she got sick and died? And she didn't smoke as much as I did, and I drank 10 times more than she did. How come she got sick and died? How come not me? And you know, you play these head games with what God's will is and all that. And I've just made up my mind that I'm not going to worry about what God's will is. I just accept what's going on today. And one thing about it is I didn't feel, while I felt sad that she died and all that, I at least I don't have to stand up here tonight and say, Jesus, if only I would have said this. I wish I would have done that. I should have done that. You know, I don't have to do that because I did it. And so I can close the door on that portion of my life. And now I've got a couple of choices I can make. You know, I can feel sorry for myself. And I know a lot of people in AA, and they'll feel sorry for me too. And they'll ask me to come over for dinner and feel sorry for me. And poor old Hank, you know, he lost his wife after all those years. Or I can choose to live. And that's what I chose to do. I chose to live. And I'm not going to hang in there with the past. You know, I can close the door on that episode of my life. And I have some good feelings and some mixed feelings. But you know, we were both sick. We had a stormy marriage, and we were both sick people. And it started. It got better towards the end, and so. But now here I am again. You know, and what am I gonna do now? And people in AA kept pulling me back into the world of the living, and they wanted to fix me up with women, all kinds of stuff, you know, and wanted me to get with it. And I thought, you know, I don't know how many months went by, 5 or 6 months or something, I don't know. All I know is I was ready. And so I'd say to myself, well, why don't you call that lady over there? You know, call her up and ask her if she'd like to go out with you. She wouldn't want to go out with you. What makes you think she'd want to go out with you? And I'd have these arguments with myself, you know. Well, just call her and find out. And I'd call. Would you want to go out Saturday night? Sure. Oh, jeez. No, now what am I going to do? You know, I don't know anything about relationships. I've been married all my life. You know. And all those feelings of fear, insecurity, and inadequacy, all those feelings came rushing back to me, and I remembered how I felt when I was 17, 18 years old. You know. And I remembered why I started the drink in the first place. And I was able, this time, to work through that without drinking. And I was asked to talk in North Carolina there about 5 years ago now, I guess, at the a little convention they have there in December, and called the Fun Fest. And I met Linda. And Linda and I had met about 10 years prior to that in Wisconsin. She got her sobriety, her early sobriety in Wisconsin. A guy that I got sober with in Los Angeles moved back home to Waukesha, Wisconsin, and started a group there, and Linda went to that group. And I met her there when I spoke in Wisconsin, and here she was in Charlotte, and we had a lot of friends in common, a lot of stuff going on. And so I says, you know, the next time I'm anywhere near Charlotte, I said, I'm going to call you up, and maybe we can go out to dinner. And she said, well, that would just be fine. And so the next time I was pretty close to where she was, I dropped by. It was only about 1,200 miles out of the way. And we started up a relationship, you know, phones and letters. And I finally moved back out, moved to Charlotte. And we got married about a year and a half ago. And we got to go to Paris. We got to go to London. And it was fantastic, you know. Wonderful life that got going here. And I can't begin to tell you the exciting things that have happened in my life once I decided to live. And it just changed everything. I got to travel all over the United States. I've been up in Canada. I've been French Martinique, even spoken there. And I've been all over, and it's just been great. And I really enjoy my sobriety. My sobriety is the most important thing that I own. You know, I don't care what happens to me. My sobriety is the center of my life. You know, it's nothing that I have to do. It's the center of my life. Everything I do comes out of that center. Everything I do comes out of my sobriety. And I have an exciting life with Linda. The one thing about Linda and me is that we were autonomous. She was, you know, self-supporting through our own contributions, not just financially, but emotionally too. Because you see, that's we weren't looking for someone to make us whole. You know, we were whole. We didn't need to be fixed. We were fixed already. So when we got married, we have this fantastic relationship. Things are going well. So about the only positive thing that I can tell you tonight, absolutely for sure, that I know about AA, because I'm not a counselor, I never did go to therapy. I don't. In my case, I didn't need to. I'm not an expert by any chance, you know, stretch of the imagination. I'm just a sober member of Alcoholics Anonymous, and I believe that that Alcoholics works. Alcoholics Anonymous works. But one amateur sharing with another amateur. One drunk sharing with another drunk. It isn't necessary to go off to a crisis specialist or a relapse specialist and all this stuff. You just go to your meetings and share one amateur with another. And I believe that. And I also know that what I heard at that first meeting that I ever attended, turns out that this really is a spiritual program. And I know that I found God when I walked through the doors of AA. And you know, it's the lights in the eyes of the people at this
turn me on and keep me coming back. Thank you very much.